This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Life across the globe is being moved by climate change. And I mean by that, snowy owls are showing up in Florida. Tropical plants in Ecuador are moving to higher, cooler elevations. But one insect is thriving in all of these warmer temperatures. The Arctic mosquito population, it's booming. Maybe not the species you were hoping for. Here to tell us about these swarms in the Arctic and other selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman. She's a writer with the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. She joins us here, as always, in our CUNY studios. Welcome.
Thanks back, Rachel. Thanks for having me
here. Let's talk about the mosquitoes.
Sure. So mosquitoes are not something that most people would be happy about, hearing that they're thriving. But indeed, they are. And it's actually not terrible news. So Arctic mosquitoes are very abundant already, very important for the area. They pollinate certain plants. They're a big source of food for a lot of birds and other insects. And researchers wanted to see how the population was going to deal with warmer temperatures. They were actually concerned that other bugs might be getting more voracious and that the mosquitoes might disappear. And they were relieved to find out that that's not true, but they also found that the mosquitoes are doing a little bit too well. They found that for every degree of warming, they were maturing about 10% faster. And that's a big problem because it's when they're in their larval stages that other insects eat them. Mm. So they're making it to adulthood at a much higher rate. With 2 degrees of warming, they found they would be 50% more likely to reach adulthood. So the population is booming. That's a problem because mosquitoes are known to pester caribou so much that the caribou will actually, move to escape the mosquitoes, and it can really have a negative impact on their reproductive rates. And in fact, 1 year that they were watching them, the mosquito sort of peak season, it moved because the temperatures were warmer and it coincided perfectly with the caribou calving season. And it kind of doubled down the population problem because the mosquitoes suddenly had this immobile, very abundant source of a blood meal, which helps them reproduce. Mm. Meanwhile, obviously, it's not great for the caribou.
And they swarm, really.
Yeah.
They're big swarms of them.
Yeah. So it's, one of those more insidious effects of climate change that now researchers are going to be paying closer attention to.
Just last week we were talking about how polar bears are starting to feed on the caribou. Now we've got the mosquitoes are going to feed on the caribou. Let's talk about the moon. Now, the moon is shrinking?
Yes, which is not new, actually. It was news to me, but apparently researchers sort of concluded a few years ago that the moon is shrinking. It's because as its molten core cools, it gets smaller. And so, the entire moon kind of shrinks on itself. Mercury is doing the same thing to a much higher degree. And we learned this because the orbiter around the moon saw these things called lobate scarps, which are these deep faults that are caused when the core shrinks and the surface and the mantle have to kind of collapse in on themselves to follow. But what they found now is that, those scarps should be random, but they have a pattern. Mm. And it turns out that pattern overlaps really well with the tidal forces that the Earth subjects the moon to. So it turns out that even though the moon is shrinking away from us and getting infinitesimally more distant every year, we do still have some influence over it, which I guess is comforting.
Yeah. And of course, the International Observe the Moon Day is this Saturday. We're going to be talking about that a little later. Do you have any moon observing plans?
Looking up, I guess. Nothing more elaborate than that.
All right. Well, I think Dean Regas will be here to talk a little bit about other things you might want to do and other ways to look at the moon. There was also a study looking at sea turtles and plastics in the ocean. Not very happy news there either.
No, really bad news. A study estimating how many turtles had encountered plastic came up with a really upsetting figure. They estimate that 52% of sea turtles have ingested plastic. It kind of speaks for itself that that's not a good thing. Sea turtles can be injured physically by the plastic. The plastic can absorb toxins in the ocean that the turtles then absorb. It can also make them feel full so that they starve to death because they have stomachs full of plastic. And in fact, one of the turtles they found to be most at risk, the Olive Ridley, is actually already endangered in some parts of the world. So that's not great. And then today, a study came out saying that there are 8 trillion microbeads released into the aquatic habitats of the U.S. every day.
8 trillion a day.
8 trillion. So those are the microbeads that are in face wash and toothpaste. And, you know, that's adding to this pollution that turtles are ingesting. So people should probably think twice about using those.
Let's see if we can wrap this up with a more interesting, funny story.
Sure.
A quirky story, because we've had bad news the last few stories you talked about. You have a story about finches and monogamy.
Yes. So zebra finches have very interesting love lives. They're socially monogamous, like humans. They couple up to raise offspring, but they're not necessarily strictly sexually monogamous their whole lives. And they also, like humans, have very individual tastes. The females very clearly want specific males, but there's no pattern. There's no one quality that makes a guy finch a real catch. So researchers wanted to see, given that there's no inherent thing that makes a male finch more attractive, they wanted to know how important this choice really is, because it seemed to be really arbitrary. So they let finches pair up, kept half of them in their pairs, and the other half they split up and reassigned randomly. And they found that the love matches, so to speak, had a 37% higher chance of having living offspring. And they think it's because the females were just less receptive to the males that they hadn't been able to pick themselves. And even though they did reproduce, they didn't pay as much attention to their offspring, and they just weren't successful.
So finch matchmaking just doesn't work out.
No. You got to let the finches be what they want to be.
Well, can finch speed dating be further down the road to the place? Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you.
Always good to have you. Rachel Feldman, a writer of Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Since it was first introduced way back in 2009, the currency of Facebook popularity has been that tiny blue upraised thumb, the like, you know, sort of an emoji. But for how much longer? On Tuesday, at a Q&A at Facebook headquarters, Mark Zuckerberg sent the tech press into a frenzy when he said this.
You know, I think people have asked about the dislike button for many years, and probably hundreds of people have asked about this. And today is a special day, because today is the day where I actually get to say that we're working on it and are very close to shipping a test of it.
You can hear the frenzy beginning there. Yeah, dislike button or something like it, I guess, is in Facebook's future. Here to talk about what's to like or dislike about Facebook's move beyond the thumbs up is Slate senior technology writer Will Oremus. Will, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
He was very careful, though, right? He was coy about whether we're going to have what we're going to have.
Yeah, the news immediately got glossed by a million tech blogs that Facebook is going to add a dislike button. That's not exactly what he said. If you listen really closely, he did say it's a special day. You know, maybe we can all agree that it's a special day when Facebook adds a button other than like. But what he said is we're working on something that's going to meet the needs of the larger community.
So it might not be a button, or so we don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is. It'll probably be some kind of button. It might be multiple buttons. They may or may not say dislike. I bet we will not get one that actually says dislike on it.
So is that the good news or the bad news?
Well, it's the good news and the bad news. But, you know, the good news is that Facebook has had one way to react to everyone's posts for all this time. It might sound trivial talking about the like button on Facebook, but this has become the dominant platform by which people interact online. It's become a dominant platform, if not the dominant platform, for how news gets shared and read online. And there's only one way to respond to all that stuff that's being shared on Facebook. That feels a little simplistic, maybe a little constraining. So the fact that they're going to move beyond just the like button definitely has its upsides.
Mm-hmm. And the bad news then?
Well, the bad news for all the haters and cynics out there is that it's not really going to be the dislike button that you're looking for. What Facebook wants to do, they're trying to solve this problem where a friend or family member of yours posts something sad, you know, some deeply personal news, you know, grandma has died, or you know, I had this awful day. And you don't want to like it because, you know, it sounds like you're right on, grandma. Right. No.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because I have thought about that. Should I press the like button on some bad news?
Exactly. So what happens is that people don't like it. But then the upshot of that is that your personal confession gets met with radio silence on Facebook. And that's like the worst thing, right? I mean, the whole reason you're posting it there is you want a little pick-me-up. You want a little affirmation. The like button, you know, that was one of the fundamental problems that he's trying to address. But he's not trying to address this other problem, which is that there's a lot of crap posted on Facebook. You know, there are hoaxes, there are lies, there are stories that are wrong or misleading, there's clickbait. There's, you know, your friends and family just posting stuff that's flat out racist or sexist. And you want to dislike that. You don't want to, you know, just not hitting the like button doesn't feel like enough. You want to say, this is terrible, and we're all dumber for having read this. You know, where's that button? That's not the button we're going to get.
What do you think? You think we're going to have a range of things you might be able to use?
Yeah, I could see this going one of two ways. One is that there will be a range of different responses besides just like. People have been coming up, having a lot of fun coming up with the different possibilities. Maybe you can hug someone or send love. The New Yorker, I think, suggested a button where you can just say you know, and so that's one possibility. The other way I could see this going, what Facebook really doesn't want is a scenario where people are discouraged from posting things on there because they're worried that everybody's going to give them the thumbs down, you know, and say, ah, that's dumb, this is bad, and make them feel bad, and then they're not going to use Facebook anymore. So one way that Facebook could avoid that is they could give the person who's doing the posting an option to say, on this post, instead of a like button, I want a sympathy button or a hug button or a, you know, I agree with you button.
We'll have to wait and see how this turns out. Willa Remus, senior technology writer at Slate. Well, thank you for coming and being with us today.
Thanks again.
We're going to take a break, and author Andrea Wolf tells us about the most famous scientist you've never heard of. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Here's a trivia question for you. Who has more places named after him than anybody else? If you're thinking George Washington, close but no cigar, not even our first president can claim a Brazilian river, a Mexican mountain, a glacier in Greenland, an area of the moon, not to mention here in the States, 4 counties and 13 towns. Give up? Well, that distinction goes to globe-trekking explorer, scientist, and environmentalist named Alexander von Humboldt, a guy whose notoriety in the 19th century made him the second most famous man in Europe after Napoleon. And today, he's mostly forgotten. But my next guest is setting out to change that. Andrea Wolf is an author and historian. A new biography of Alexander von Humboldt is called The Invention of Nature, and in it she argues that Humboldt did nothing less than change our understanding of nature. Andrea, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
If we know the name Humboldt today, it's probably because of Humboldt Park in Chicago, right? We have Humboldt County in California. What was Humboldt's reputation in his day?
Well, he was the most famous scientist of his age, which, you know, seems mad to us now because very few people, at least in the English-speaking world, have heard about him. Every school child in the mid-19th century had heard his name. Every scientist who went to Europe went to Paris, where he lived, or later to Berlin, where he lived, to see him. It was like a rite of passage, basically.
Not even our most famous scientists today. All right, as you say, as famous as Humboldt. What did he specialize in?
Well, that's the thing. He didn't specialize in anything. He was a genius polymath who really roamed across the disciplines. He was interested in nature as a whole. In fact, he comes up with this concept of nature as an interconnected whole, as nature as a web of life, or we would call it today as an ecosystem, although he didn't use the term. So he was looking at plants, for example, not through the narrow lens of classification as other scientists, but looking at them in terms of their vegetation zones, their habitats, the climate. So he looks at Earth as this living organism.
He didn't coin the Gaia principle, did he?
He did not, but interestingly, he comes up with exactly that idea, and he writes a book which he calls Cosmos in the mid-19th century, and he is initially considering calling it Gaia.
No kidding. But he's sort of invented... he sort of invented ecology, you know, the study of the whole system.
Yes, he's very much interested in this. I mean, he sees nature almost like as this tapestry where he looks at animals within their habitat, at plants within their habitat. And then because he sees nature as a web of life, he also realizes that nature is threatened. So if you see nature as a tapestry, you basically, when you pull one thread, the whole thing might unravel. So he also becomes the father of environmentalism, really, because he predicts harmful human-induced climate change in 1800.
How did he get interested in all of this? Where does he come from?
So he's this... what I love about him is that he's not this kind of cerebral scholar. He is brazenly adventurous. He comes from a very wealthy Prussian family in Berlin, and when his parents die, he basically spends his entire inheritance on a five-year exploration of Latin America. And he ventures deep into the rainforest in Venezuela and across the Andes. And he's kind of physically incredibly fit, and he sees all these different parts of the world. And he realizes that there are similarities across continents. So he really defines these kind of global vegetation and climate zones. All these things we take for absolutely for granted today, but which were completely new at his time.
Hmm. You describe, in that vein, you describe a pivotal moment when he climbs up Ecuador's mountain, considered to be the highest in the world at that point.
And what
was so pivotal about that climb?
So he climbs Chimborazo, which is then believed to be the highest mountain in the world, which is about 100 miles south of Quito in today's Ecuador. And he climbs up and he reaches more than 19,000 feet. So no one has ever been that high as he has. And he holds the world record for several decades. And he sees, as he's standing on top of the world, he looks down and his vision of nature clarifies, because what he realizes is that the journey from Quito up to the peak of Chimborazo was like a botanical journey from the equator to the pole. So he sees the tropical species like banana trees and palm trees in the valley, and then the further up he comes, the kind of the plants changes according to altitude, and he realizes that the plants he's seeing on Chimborazo are very similar to some of the plants he's seen before in Europe, say, for example, in the Alps in Switzerland or in the Pyrenees in Spain. So he realizes that there are these corresponding vegetation zones across the globe. So what clarifies at that moment really for him is that nature is a global force. And that's an extraordinary concept to have at that time.
But he's also a gifted artist, because he draws a picture, right, of the mountain.
Yes, he draws something which, because he's German, he calls a Naturgemälde, which is really, it's a painting of nature, but it means more like a microcosm of nature on one page. And what he does is he takes a cross-section of the mountain, of the Chimborazo, and he writes all the names of the plants he finds on Chimborazo according to their altitude onto the mountain. And then he has 20 columns to the left and to the right where he gives data such as gravity, humidity, the blueness of the sky, the chemical components of the air, all according to altitude. So basically you can look at one column and you can see everything you can find at a certain altitude on a mountain, and then he gives the altitude of other mountains across the world. So what you have here, you have for the very first time a scientist who uses a graphic to visualize his data.
And in fact, in 2012, scientists were using that graphic to research his footsteps up the mountain. They used his vegetation map as data.
Yeah, which, you know, this is so extraordinary, isn't it? You think this is, you know, Humboldt died in 1859. He climbed Chimborazo in 1802. But his data is still used by climate scientists to show that climate change has moved the plants up by 500 meters.
In case you just joined us, we're talking with Andrea Wolf about the lost science hero Alexander von Humboldt in the book The Invention of Nature on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, I've got to ask at this point, we've talked so much about him, what happened? I mean, why did his name drop off the map, or so to speak?
I think there are several reasons for that. One is, I think, that some of his ideas have become so self-evident almost. We have absorbed them almost by osmosis that we've forgotten the man behind them. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that he's really the last of all polymaths. So he dies in 1859, which is really the last moment where one person can hold all the knowledge of the world in one head, basically, because after that, the sciences specialize so much. So scientists become experts, and they actually look down on people like Humboldt and regard them like amateurs. And then the third reason, which I think is the most important reason, really, is that he is famous until World War I. And then, you know, neither America nor England is really the right place to celebrate a German scientist. This is a time when the English royal family, for example, changes their surname to Windsor because their other surname sounded too German, where you have public libraries in America burning German books. So he gets really pushed away. And the interesting thing is that in Latin America, where, you know, he traveled for 5 years, he is famous. He's as famous as Jefferson and Washington is famous here, because he was quite instrumental in the through his friendship with Simon Bolivar in the revolutions in South America.
I want to stick around on this mountain because we asked a scientist to retrace some of the steps, because it was such a seminal journey up there. So we asked Nyamura Wedaholm to explain what her team found going up there.
We decided to go in his footsteps to see whether there have been any changes at all in response to the human-driven climate change that has happened since his time. We surveyed the area and the vegetation going out in transects every 100 meters of elevation and noting everything that we found. On average, all the plant species have shifted upwards and grow about 500 meters, so 1,500 feet higher up than what Humboldt found.
That's Nyamura Wedaholm talking about retracing Humboldt's steps. And, of course, as you say, what they found really was different than what he had found when he went up the mountain.
Yes, they basically worked out that in tandem with the rising temperatures and with the retreat of the glacier that the plants had moved up. And to me, it seems incredibly appropriate that they are using Humboldt's data, because, you know, he warned that humankind was meddling with the climate.
Yeah.
He said, you know, that this could have unforeseeable impact on future generations. He warned of monoculture, of deforestation, of irrigation, and extraordinarily, he also warned that that humankind was affecting the climate through the great masses of steam and gas from the industrial centers.
We asked Naya to talk about the journey, what it was like going up that mountain, and this is what she said.
The journey up the Chimborazo volcano was really challenging. Actually, half of our team was not able to continue and make the last parts of the field work. It definitely gave me a renewed disrespect for how Humboldt actually managed to get up there and so high 210 years ago. We had much better gear, and still we had to struggle a lot with the thin air and the slippery conditions.
Andrea, I know that you made the trek yourself. Was it as bad as Naya said?
I very much agree with her. It was one of the most incredible things I've ever done. I went up, so Chimborazo is just under 21,000 feet. Humboldt went up to a bit over 19,000 feet, and I got up to 16,400. And, you know, as I walked up the barren mountain slope with every single step, you know, my admiration for him just kind of grew, because as they say, you know, he walks up there with really bad shoes. I mean, so bad that the jagged rocks tear the soles of the shoes, and they have bleeding feet. They're eyes are bloodshot, their gums are bleeding. And he, every few hundred yards, he stops, he takes out his instruments, he measures gravity, humidity, the blueness of the sky, and then he just marches on. It's just unbelievable what he did.
And this was, even before that giant age of exploration that would come a few years later. He was a compulsive experimenter, right? A lot of his experiments were pretty dangerous, though, weren't they?
Yeah. There's some wonderful description. He's very interested in something which they then called animal electricity, because they were looking at if there was like a force, a kind of creative force, a vital force within animals. How was an organism created? So he did all these experiments with frogs, for example, where they cut into the animal legs and put metal rods in and electrodes and stuff like that. And then he started using his own body. So he works at that time as a mining instructor in Prussia. And in the evenings, he sits down, he cuts himself and kind of rubs his wounds with chemicals. And then later in Latin America, he's really interested in electric eels, which are these kind of very strange fish which discharge a voltage of 600 volt, and they live in ponds in the mud. So they get their locals to drive 30 wild horses into the pond. Now the hooves of the horses drive up the electric eels, which then discharge their electricity, and then they kind of take them and start dissecting them. But they kind of take them too early, so he gets lots of electric shocks. Oh. And he's, you know, at the end he says, like, I was very tired and feeble.
We're talking with Andrea Wolf about Alexander von Humboldt, the invention of nature, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You talk so much about, I mean, it's hard to figure out. He was all over the world. We're talking about, you know, South America, but he went all over the place, didn't he? Well, he had a relationship with Charles Darwin.
Yes. Well, Charles Darwin was admired Humboldt, and actually Charles Darwin said that he would have not boarded the Beagle and therefore not conceived the Origin of Species without Humboldt. So Darwin, as a young man, read Humboldt's books, and that actually made him go to South America. Once he was in South America, Charles Darwin then said that he could really only see the new world through the lens of Humboldt's writings. Then later he modeled his own writings on Humboldt's books, like Voyage of the Beagle, very similar in style. And he also used Humboldt's books as source material, really, while he was working on his evolutionary theory. So he was greatly influenced by Humboldt. But there's this wonderful scene where Darwin meets Humboldt finally in 1842. So this is after the Beagle, and this hero of his, which has really grown to like mythical dimensions in his head, is this old man who's so used to being the center of attention and who just talks all the time, and Darwin can't get a single word in, and is really disappointed.
We have all kinds of tweets coming in. People have Googled Humboldt and come up with some interesting questions, like is this the same Humboldt that the Humboldt current is named?
Correct. Correct. It is. Basically everything. I mean, wherever you turn. Even the state of Nevada was almost called Humboldt when the name was discussed in the 1860s.
No kidding.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? Las Vegas Humboldt? I quite like to say that now.
Well, but I can't think of anybody besides, you know, maybe Stephen Hawking or somebody who was so internationally famous that you'd want to name things after.
Yeah, and imagine it would be like in 100 years, everybody would have forgotten the name Hawkins.
Right.
That's how it is.
He was an emotional guy. You really get involved in what he was doing?
Yes, he was. I mean, he's also a flawed character, but he is this unbelievably restless mind. He says he's, you know, he's driven, he feels chased as if by 10,000 pigs, and he's like forever curious. And he, you know, as a 60-year-old, he travels 10,000 miles through Russia in 6 months using more than 12,000 horses. So he wow. just never stops. It basically, until he drops dead, almost, you know, like a few months before his 90th birthday, he's just on his feet all the time.
All right. We're going to come back and talk more with Andrea Wolf about Humboldt, the invention of nature. I think his birthday is this week, isn't it?
It was on Monday.
It was on Monday.
Well, yes.
Happy birthday. We're going to come back, as I say, celebrate his birthday a bit more after this break. Our number, 844-724-8255. Maybe we can get a call or two in before we say goodbye. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about a lost hero of science, Alexander von Humboldt, who in his day, Humboldt was called the Shakespeare of the sciences. And in her new book, The Invention of Nature, my guest Andrea Wolfe calls him the forgotten father of environmentalism. What do you mean by that, Andrea?
Well, he's really the first one to understand harmful human-induced climate change. He's also the first one to explain the fundamental functions of the forest for the ecosystem, for the climate. So he talks about the tree's ability to store water, to protect the soil against soil erosions. So he understands nature as an ecosystem without calling it an ecosystem. So he basically, everything that comes after him is really based on that. And he also inspires, and I think that's incredibly important, he inspires people like John Muir, for example. So John Muir, the father of the national parks, learns his lessons on forest preservation from Humboldt.
Wow. And he wasn't just analytical. I mean, he believed, right, in bringing emotion to science, or as scientists today try to be emotionless. He was very emotional. He thought you had to be committed and emotional.
Yeah, so on the one hand, he's obsessed with measurements. That's why he schleps around his instruments through Latin America. But he also says that we have to use our imagination and our emotions to understand nature. So he really bridges enlightenment and romanticism. But he also provides people like Henry David Thoreau, for example, with an answer to how to bring together poetry and science. And I think, people like John Muir, for example, really follow Humboldt in that you can only protect nature if you really love nature. So these guys are all driven by this sense of wonder and this love of nature.
Right. You know, it sounds like you're sort of trying to spread the word about Humboldt. And it sounds like it's become a crusade. It's sort of a crusade for you.
Yes, it's absolutely a mission. It's weird. So this, I've written a few books, and this is for the first time that I don't feel like I'm on a publicity tour for my book. It's like I'm on a publicity tour for Humboldt. I want everyone to know him, because he needs to be restored to his, rightful place in the pantheon of nature and science. He's incredibly important, and he's shaped the way we think about nature, and everyone should know about him.
How do you do that?
Well, I try to tell a good story about him. I try to do him justice with this book. Because I'm German, I was able to kind of read a lot of the German original sources, because he's really suffered from some very bad English translations of his books, because his books are beautiful. And he writes really in his writing is a blueprint of all nature writing today, because he combines these evocative landscape descriptions with scientific observation. Mm. So, I try my best.
Well, is now a good time? Is the time right in society and culture, environmentalism, global warming, all that stuff?
I think there are, he is incredibly relevant at the moment, because, well, one thing is that his story really explains why we understand nature the way we do it. But he's also, one of his greatest achievements was to make knowledge accessible and popular. He wanted to unite scientists, he wanted to foster communication across disciplines, which is all incredible. These are incredibly important pillars of science today, and probably most importantly today, as scientists are trying to predict and understand the global consequences of climate change, his Humboldt's interdisciplinary methods and his idea that nature is one of global patterns remains resoundingly topical. And the other thing is that he looked at colonialism and the destruction of the environment as one system. So his insight that economic, social, and political issues are connected to environmental problems is, sadly still incredibly important today.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call. And let's go to Tony in Baltimore. Hi, Tony.
Hey, how are you? I'd just like to say my grandfather, who was Chilean, and is Chilean-German, his name was Heinrich Kaltwasser, he he used to always tell us that two of his distant relatives were on the Humboldt expedition. They were Bavarian, and they fell in love with southern Chile. And after they got back to Germany, they packed the entire family up. And actually, I believe he said they purchased one of the vessels used and were able to move the entire family from Bavaria to southern Chile.
I think that's an expedition that was inspired by Humboldt, because Humboldt himself really only traveled with the French botanist Aimé Bonpland, and he went the furthest south he went was Lima, but there were quite a few Germans who then wanted to follow his footsteps, and quite a few actually also went to Brazil. So there are quite a few explorers who went basically in the name of Humboldt to explore mm-hmm. South America.
Well, this week being Humboldt's birthday, what would be the best way for everybody who wants to celebrate? What should we do?
Well, I think, you know, we should have a good look around and see what we're doing to our environment at the moment.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's a good way to end this interview. And it's a great book. I want to know where I can get some of those color plates that you have, you know, the picture, the map, his drawings and stuff like that.
They're gorgeous, aren't they?
They are. Are they available?
I don't think, I mean, I've only seen them in the original old books, which are huge portfolios, which are, you know, incredibly valuable. I mean, there were never that many printed of those, but they are absolutely gorgeous. So we were very lucky to kind of reprint some of them in the color plate section. They just look stunning.
Well, we're very lucky, Andrea, for you to have you write this book for us. It's a terrific book. I highly recommend it. And thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about Humboldt.
Absolutely. Andrea Wolf, who is the author of a book about Alexander Humboldt, The Invention of Nature. You're looking for something to celebrate besides Alexander von Humboldt? Tomorrow is International Observe the Moon Day. I'm guessing it wasn't at the top of your list, but it should be, because with a supermoon, a total lunar eclipse still to come this month, it is a good time to get in the habit of looking up at your night sky. And joining me now to give us a dose of lunar lore and share some moon viewing tips is Dean Regas, outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of the PBS series Stargazers. He joins us from Cincinnati Radio Studios. Welcome back to the program, Dean.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this. What's the point of the International Observe the Moon Night?
Well, a group of astronomers thought, all right, in the past, we have people come to visit us. We have them come to our telescopes. What if we bring our telescopes to where the people are? And something like the moon, if you're like right under a streetlight or in a city center, that's no problem. You can still see the moon awesomely through a telescope. So these astronomers made this worldwide effort to say, okay, we're going to bring telescopes to where the public is. And we've set up some great places that, you know, the people are already there. They're just walking by having their dinner. They're going to a movie. They're going to a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And then they see these people with telescopes, and they come up and they put their eye up to the telescope and behold the moon. And it's really a cool event.
It is cool. And, you know, when I watch it, it's even better when you only have half a moon to look at, because the shadows help you see the detail. But we're looking forward later this month to something really impressive. An eclipse?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this weekend, we have about, it's a first quarter moon, so we got half of the moon lit up, and so that's the best time to look with a telescope. But next Sunday is the big one. Are you seating down for this, Ira?
This is
huge. Ready. Okay, good. Because Sunday the 27th, we're going to have a lunar eclipse, total lunar eclipse. That's not that rare, because this is our fourth in a row, four in a year and a half. But it's also the night of the supermoon and the harvest moon and the completion of the infamous tetrad.
What is the tetrad? I mean, to those other three things you mentioned, that's not the tetrad.
You know, the supermoon is the closest full moon of the year. This is kind of an invented term that some astronomers kind of scoff at, and I don't know what I think of it yet. But a supermoon, this was kind of invented a few years ago to highlight that the moon changes its distance from us. Mm. And so every year the full moon is closest to us, and it looks pretty significantly larger. You can tell the difference. I found a lot of people that can. Then we've got the harvest moon, because it's the full moon closest to the fall equinox. And then the tetrad is, well, this is the fourth of a series of four lunar eclipses back to back to back to back, which is semi-rare, but putting it all together, this is like this is going to blow people's minds, I think.
Well, they're calling it the blood moon. That's not that's pretty scary. It's not a Halloween moon, right?
I forgot to add that title to it also. Blood moon, too. I also found out it's Chocolate Milk Awareness Day, but that's something else. Now, the blood moon is because it actually turns this eerie orangish-reddish color. It's not really blood, I don't think. It's we're trying to hype it a little bit, but let's bring it down to reality. It's more of like a grayish orange, and what you're seeing is the sunlight passing through the Earth's atmosphere and almost shining all of the sunsets and sunrises of Earth onto the moon itself. It's a beautiful sight.
And when will it start? How do we get ready? What should we be wearing outside? Or, you know, give us a moon party.
Oh, yeah. The good news is it's pretty much visible from anywhere in the United States. I'm going to give Eastern time for people to be watching it, but 9:07 is when the eclipse begins, so 9:07 p.m., the partial eclipse starts, and that's when you start to see the shadow of the Earth cross over the moon. Then it's in total eclipse from 10:11 to 11:23 at night, where that's where it turns the weird colors and oranges and everything. And then the full moon returns back to normal again at 12:27 a.m. Now, this is kind of confusing because some of the websites say this happens on the 28th. And that is correct for folks in Europe and England, but not for us in America. It's on the 27th is when it starts that night.
So you have a long time. I don't remember an eclipse lasting, an hour? Total eclipse?
This is a long one because the moon is going to go pretty close to the center of our Earth's shadow. So it's going to take a long time to cross through. From beginning to end, it's somewhere usually around 3 hours. This one's going to be a little short of 3.5.
And there was some news this week about new findings of moonquakes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the seismic, they put some seismometers, the Apollo missions, when they went up there, they left some on the moon. And we've been analyzing the data to see, you know, does the moon quake? And sure enough, it does. These seismometers are so precise that they can actually pick up when a meteor strikes the moon and pick up the vibrations from a meteor. But they've also found some other things that the moon seems to quake and tremble for unknown reasons. We still have a lot to learn about this, but pretty exciting stuff that the moon is active as well.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Dean Regas, astronomer at Cincinnati Observatory, co-host of PBS's Stargazers. Now, there was some really exciting news this week about another moon, not our own moon. I know you have a favorite moon that this one is about. Tell us about what that story was all about.
Well, I guess I've done this long enough. I have favorite stars, I have favorite planets, I have favorite moons. This is my new favorite moon. It's kind of it's called Enceladus. It's a moon of Saturn. And we're learning a lot from the spacecraft called the Cassini spacecraft. It's a very underrated spacecraft mission, and it's kind of under the radar, but I highly recommend people looking at the Cassini website, because it's the spacecraft that's been there since 2004, and the pictures of Saturn with the rings and the moons is just gorgeous. You'll waste a whole afternoon. Just do it now. It's Friday. You might as well just do it. Go to the Cassini website. But the news from Enceladus is that it has a liquid ocean beneath the ice. This is a moon that's very small and almost a billion miles from the sun, but we have liquid water below the surface on a moon. That is super exciting.
You mean the whole surface of the moon is covered by an ocean, and then there's ice on top of it?
Ice on top of that, and a liquid ocean underneath that ice. And it looks to be global, like it's not just parts of the moon, it's the entire moon. There's a lot of hints to this, and Enceladus is pretty cool because it has geysers on it that shoot with such force that they escape the moon's gravity. They shoot off into space. So imagine Old Faithful going off every hour shooting into space.
Wow.
That's what these geysers are like. And so you can see the plumes going into space, and Saturn's known for all of its rings, but this moon, as it orbits Saturn itself, leaves its own ring behind. I mean, is that cool or what?
That is really good. When you talk about water, liquid water, could there be life in that liquid water?
That is our hope. We're hoping so because this is a surprise for the last 15 years is that the amount of water we found in a variety of places in the solar system. We found water on Mars. We found water on Ganymede, a moon of Jupiter. Europa, another moon of Jupiter. Even on Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, we found water. And so now Enceladus is on the list as of a water world. Could there be life there? This is tricky because, you know, it's covered in ice. How long has the water been there in liquid form? Has there been enough time for anything to be happening? Is it stable? A lot of unanswered questions, but Enceladus is on the list, the short list of potential life-bearing worlds.
So as we're looking and thinking about our moon this weekend, what do we not know about our moon that we need to know or would like to know or you would like to know?
Well, I would like to know how I can get there. That would be fun, first of all. I would love to be one of the astronauts that goes to the moon. It's like a week-long trip to go to the moon and back. I'd love to do that. That sounds better than going to Mars for me. But the thing that I really like about the moon whenever I look at it is when people look through a telescope at the moon and the reactions I get, I really like them. They say, oh, wow, look at, I mean, you can see the craters. It looks like a bad movie set to a lot of people.
All right.
And what I like is where the moon came from, that it broke off of the Earth. And I'd like to learn more about that.
It is fascinating. Dean Regas, outreach astronomer at Cincinnati University, co-host of the PBS series Stargazers. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Keep looking up.
And if you just can't get enough moon, we've got more information about the upcoming supermoon as well as moon maps and moon activities up on our website at sciencefriday.com/observatory. sciencefriday.com/observe the moon. One last thing. A German designer, Philip Schmidt, has come up with an idea for a camera that'll combat what he sees as monotony of photos on social media. As he puts it, if the camera decides that too many photos have been taken at your location, it retracts the shutter and blocks the viewfinder. You can't take any more pictures here. Now, I wonder, is this a good idea? If I want to snap the Eiffel Tower or the Washington Monument a few more times, no one's Flickr photos are going to censor my scene. I'm not so crazy about this. George Orwell, you missed this one. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim, our associate producer. SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, video producer. Production assistant, Becky Fogel, our technical director. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Join us on Facebook. We tweet all week at SciFry. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.